Okay, great. Hello, everyone. This is Premier Chess CEO, National Master Evan Rabin, and I am very excited to be here on the Premier Chess Podcast, episode 169, with a very special guest, Grandmaster Alex Fishbein, who is a strong Russian Grandmaster who immigrated to the U.S. with his family in 1979. A couple years later, actually, in 1985, he won the first Denker Tournament of High School Champions. So, Alex, you know, I guess the first kind of fun question, you know, tell us a little bit more about that tournament. I know now, for those people that don't know, it's a tournament that takes place every year with the state champion from every state. And then they kind of compete, you know, for something bigger, you know, a national title. So, yeah, tell us what it was like, you know, playing in and winning the first Denker Tournament.
Yeah, it was interesting because that was the first one. And I don't think anybody thought that it would become the kind of tradition it has become. And in fact, when it was held, it was not called, the very first tournament was not called the Denker. It was called the National Tournament of High School Champions. And only, and then after the tournament
and concluded, where was it got held, renamed. Alex?
It was held in Florida, in Hollywood, Florida, at the same time as the US Open. That, and for me, it was an exciting trip. First of all, to go to Florida for the first time for, you know, for a teenager would have been exciting. And so I was able to actually, you know, we didn't necessarily have a great deal of money, but I was able to raise some funds in Colorado for the trip by giving a lot of simuls. And I remember giving those simuls, everybody said, you know, you should go there and, you know, show them who's boss. But I was not at all, I did not at all consider myself the favorite to win, although on paper I probably was with the highest rating in the field. By a little bit. So I managed to beat Adam Leaf in the last round and get clear first place in that tournament.
Awesome. So yeah, I know like now it's definitely a COVID-ed tournament. You know, gives chess scholarships year after year. I believe
right.
University of Texas at Dallas and a couple of other a couple other schools give scholarships.
Right.
You know, to the winners of the tournament. I was just actually talking to the dean of the Scholastic Chess, Dwayne Barber,
right.
Last week at the U.S. Open, who is very, very, very gratefully one of those who actually sponsor a lot of the sponsorships there.
Yes.
And, yeah, Dwayne, of course, has also, as you may know, has been on the podcast, actually. So, yeah, he's definitely one of the biggest figures of chess today, and you know, couldn't be more grateful for all that he does. But anyway, this is Alex time, not Dwayne time. So, the right. first thing that I wanted to you know, ask you about, which I ask, you know, all the title players that come on the show, is just to ask you a little bit about, you know, some general tips for chess improvement. You know, I'm sure you've worked with plenty of players like myself. You know, relatively young, I'm a national master.
Right.
But, you know, also became master relatively young when you were 14. But you know, obviously took off and, you know, became a title player. So, what would you say, you know, if you had to say maybe one or two, three, you know, top improvement tips that brought you to Grandmaster, what might those.
Well, it's tough for me because I have, you know, I haven't done a great deal of coaching. I've done a little bit of coaching. Obviously, my son is a master, so I helped him get to the level where he is. But and when I was young, I think I had a good coach. My first coach here in America was Dmitry Gurevich. He's a grandmaster, and we had a very good relationship. I mean, he's also from the Soviet Union. And, you know, we spoke the same language, both in terms of language and in terms of chess. He helped me a lot. He helped me get from the 20. I actually, when I got to 2200, I kind of hung around there for a couple of years. I wasn't moving forward very, very much. Then when I met him, I immediately jumped up to about 2400 within less than a year after I met him. But I think that, and he taught me a lot of the methods that were kind of, you know, well known in Russia. And a lot of it has to do with finding what your weaknesses are and try to kind of eradicate them. And, you know, there's a lot of literature that can help you do that. And I still, you know, for players at this level, like master and above, I think that's the key, you know, because you when you get to master level, you kind of already are, you know a lot of things already, you know, end games, some end games, openings, middle games, positional play. But there's going to be subtle weaknesses. Like you might be, for example, not very good in positions that require taking initiative or playing very aggressively or playing sharp. Or on the other hand, you might not be good in positions where you have to defend, or you might not be good in the end, might not be as good in the end game, or you might be, you know, missing opponents' counterplay or things like that. So what I do, and what I've always done since then is, you know, the last tournament that I played or the last couple of tournaments that I played, if I lost a couple of games or if I didn't do well, I kind of tried to generalize, like, what did I do wrong? What made me lose those games? You know, was it overconfidence? Was it, you know, insufficient attention to detail? You know, what were the things that made me go wrong? And then what I try to do is I try to find in the literature, and I have a lot of literature, a lot of books, examples of players who either corrected those mistakes and write about it, that would be perfect, or just made those same mistakes in their games and talked about it. And then I can
get a feeling for what needs to be done. A little bit, you know, with regard to, you know, tips or improvement, you're talking about the idea of, you know, analyzing your games and, you know, looking for themes in your mistakes, which is very important. One thing I often do with students, you know, after reviewing a game, I'll look for the top one or two things that they should learn, you know, from the game. Of course, you mentioned end game, which is, you know, a very common theme. You know, I was actually rooming at the U.S. Open with Grandmaster Robert Mungoski. And one thing that he really surprised me with, quite frankly, he was actually playing someone around my level, a little lower rated, you know, like 2150. And, you know, he outplayed him in an end game. And he gets back to the hotel room at like 12:30. I was like exhausted. I was like, I have to go to sleep.
Right.
And he was like, Evan, I have to go over the game with you. I was like, fine. Okay. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And he said, like, wow, he got into this end game and I knew he was going to blunder. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, he's around my level. Right. Like, honestly, I don't beat 2150s that easily. You know, and meanwhile, he was just like, wow, I got into this end game and, you know, and knew he was going to make mistakes and lose. To me, I'd be thinking, like, in that end game, like, how am I going to win? You know, but yet he was like, you know, literally like gung ho that he was going to win, you know, starting from that position. So can you talk a little bit about like the importance of end game study?
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever had that experience, but I can sort of identify with, you know, having to go over the game right after you played it. Like, you can't go to sleep before going over the game, that's for sure. But yeah, I mean, there's some people, sometimes I play players and it just feels like, you know, just judging from how they, you know, their style or what the decisions they make during the game, that they're going to feel a little bit less, you know, less confident in a more technical position. And by the way, an end game doesn't mean that you don't have to, actually the end game, you have to calculate more. So, you know, people play intuitively, people who can't calculate are going to have problems in the end game because a lot of end.
And that is like an important idea. You know, a lot of beginners think, oh, there's, you know, especially just today at our, we have a chess and in-person chess and sports camp in the city going on. And yeah, I mean, you know, one kid today like thought this position was so simple because, you know, it was actually the setup position that I was teaching them.
Right.
And you know, he didn't realize that without, you know, thinking and knowing a little bit of technique, you know, okay, it's not that easy, you know, to win the game. So, you know, clearly, you know, technique is, you know, very important. So actually, another question I was going to, you know, ask you actually, and this was kind of actually stirred from the conversation we had at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
You know, I realize your son, you know, is a master, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my good friends, Todd Bryant, is, you know, actually around my level. He's a master.
Yeah, I played him.
You know, and his son is actually taking private lessons with me because, you know, he has literally no interest, you know, in learning with his dad.
Yeah, that's
so I was just kind of curious if you have, you know, any, you know, sort of anecdotes about, you know, working with your son and, you know, helping
it's,
him?
It's,
you know,
very hard. I mean, my son doesn't really like Mitch. It was never. I mean, it's hard to be taught by your father, and it's hard to kind of like prepare a structured lesson. And sometimes you have to do that. I mean, I had structured training with Dimitri when I was, you know, that strength. So it is tough. But on the other hand, though, whenever I've suggested to Mitch that, you know, maybe he should take some lessons with someone like Joe Benjamin or, you know, somebody, and he said, no way. No, I don't want any, I'm just gonna, you know. So we don't really have structured lessons. That would be impossible. But a lot of times he just watches me play on chess.com, for example, or you know, I just show him games and we kind of go over it, you know.
So have your two other kids ever picked up chess at all?
Have my other kids picked up chess? Is that the question?
Yeah, have your two other kids picked up chess at all?
One of them did, Sam. He was about 1,100 or so, but then he stopped playing. But Mitch, I mean, at the time Sam was 1,100, Mitch was probably very similar, but Mitch was just more interested and kind of continued on. It seemed from the beginning that he would be more interested.
Yeah, and it's interesting because sibling rivals could definitely have, you know, big impact. You know, but I know, for instance, you know, Robert Hess, I've known him since he was six. His older sister, Alexandra, you know, was, you know, pretty big into chess, higher rated than him. And then once he just kind of shot up, you know, Alexandra stopped.
Right.
I know for a fact, you know, Hikaru and Asuka, you know, similar story.
Right.
You know, Asuka Nakamura was, you know, a strong master. More or less.
I think so.
You know, yeah. Then he basically stopped. Hikaru, you know, shot up.
Well, he still plays on the internet. He's tough to beat, so.
Yeah, and he's definitely not a fish, and you know, who knows, you know, what would have been the case otherwise.
Right.
You know, I am very close.
Could be that. Could be it. I don't know, but it could be that. Could be the reason. But I felt from the beginning that you know, Mitch just had more interest. Was more interested. You know, and by the way, I'm not really, you know, I don't put pressure on kids to, like, you know, they if they're interested, they should play. If not, you know, there are other things to do. A lot of other things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, passion is important. You know, it's definitely a very easy way, actually, unfortunately, right, for kids to die out in chess. I could definitely think of a few prodigies who basically, you know, gave up chess, you know, because of, you know, their parents pushing them. And I know others who were, you know, almost about to give up chess, you know, because their parents were pushing them too much. So, I do always say that, you know, of course, the number one thing is, you know, to have fun, you know, of course, you know, learn, you know, the best way, you know, that you can, that, you know, really interesting. You obviously, like many players, you know, immigrated from Russia. Now there are more and more U.S. born players, actually. I mean, you obviously don't have an accent, really. So, you know, truly, until we probably, I think, spoke for the first time in person, you know, a couple weeks ago at the U.S. Open, I didn't even know that you were, you know, an immigrant from Russia. You know, can you tell us Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, when your family did immigrate here and sort of why that was?
Right. Why that? So we came in 1979. We were Jewish, and we were trying to, you know, escape from anti-Semitism, which was significant in the Soviet Union, obviously, especially after the Second World War. And I think that, you know, there were other reasons as well. Like, I think just the country was kind of, you could see the country was falling apart. You could see economically it wasn't doing well, but I think that the political reasons were the most, and we had a family. It wasn't just me, right? It was my parents, my grandparents, you know, but I think it was, and my dad had a couple of sisters who had left earlier, who had already been here when we came. And they were all basically the same reason. It was a lot of Jewish people left Russia at that time. I think, you know, I think probably 3/4 of the population, Jewish population, left in about 5 or 10 years, you know. for similar reasons.
Yeah, well, look, I could certainly relate to that. I was born here, of course, but my great grandparents were from Belarus and Lithuania. And then moved here. My good friend Deborah Brunner runs a nonprofit called the Together Plan, which actually specifically connects Belarusians around the world. Thanks to her, actually, I found out that after talking to my grandmother more, realized my great grandmother is actually from Belarus.
My grandmother was also from Belarus. We called it Belarus at that time.
Oh wow!
My mother's side.
By the way, there's so many Belarusian top chess players, which I didn't even know about until Deborah actually wrote a very interesting guest blog post about Belarusian players. Found out players like Shulman, is from Belarus. Many other, top players, are from there. So, it's definitely rather fascinating. Honestly, probably the biggest reason that I wanted to bring you on the podcast actually is, there are many chess players in finance. As you may know, we actually, currently do classes at Citigroup. We also do classes at a private equity firm. We do see a lot of, ties, from chess to finance. Just a couple weeks ago, we actually did a great chess and hedge fund event where we actually had three great speakers who all happened to be on our podcast. Andy Stein, a former Citigroup firm's investment banker who actually now runs a huge nonprofit, Orphan Starfish Foundation, made Evan Katz, who does a lot of chess fundraising. He's also a chess player. And we had Christopher Hunt, who's also been on our podcast and does, M&A consulting. It was definitely, a great event. But can you talk? I know you work, at TD Securities. Could you talk a little bit about how, being, such a great chess player helps you in your finance career?
Well, I'm sorry, can you say it again? I lost the last sentence.
Could you talk a little bit more about how, being such a strong chess player, a grandmaster, helped you in your finance career?
Sure. For me, it was, and I've been working in finance since 1993. So actually, I became a grandmaster in 92. And then the next year, I started working at a firm called Kidder Peabody a long time ago, no longer exists. It was bought by Payne Webber, which then was bought by UBS, but I was at those three firms for about 10, 15 years. A lot of times to get into that job requires something like either an Ivy League education or something close to that. I didn't have any of that, but chess was sort of compensated for that. So people thought that, if I'm a chess player, I'm a grandmaster, I must be smart. So, they hired me mainly for that reason. I didn't really have any other credentials. I mean, I had a bachelor's degree in math and computer science, but that wouldn't have gotten me that job. That alone wouldn't have gotten me that job. And I think all through my career, it was sort of I think I was always known for more for actually being a chess player than what I was doing. And I think it always added a certain amount of gravitas or whatever. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's people kind of always respected that, appreciated that. But as I progressed, I was became successful in what I was doing. I was working in mortgage-backed securities most of the time in various roles, including trading, portfolio management, research, and technology and strategy, all these things. Currently I'm doing strategy. So, I think that, I don't know, it just adds a certain amount of respect, respected sport, respected game on Wall Street. And I think that on the other hand, I think it also, one of the things I'm proud of is I have kept kept with a lot of people in my generation who started playing, started working around that time, kind of dropped out of chess. Like, for example, Patrick Wolf, who was a more talented
player than me. Was on our podcast 2 weeks ago.
So. Right? More talented player than me, unquestionably. He was U.S. champion in 1992. But he stopped playing. He didn't really play a lot for many years. Rachel's, who I saw a couple weeks ago, he was at the U.S. Open, I think. Similar, you know. You know, and I've stayed with chess. I don't know if it's because I'm more passionate about it, or maybe it's because I haven't reached some of the pinnacles that they had reached. That's possible too. But I think it has kept my mind sharp. At least for me, I think it's been useful to just to keep sharp. I think I'm just as sharp now as I was when I was 25, and that includes working. You know, do things I can do at work. You know, my brain operates with the same fluidity as it did then. And I think chess helps that in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely raised some interesting points there. You know, and it reminds me actually of an episode of the Perpetual podcast that Grandmaster Pascal Charbonneau did, who of course you know. And he talked a lot about
Grandmaster who? Sorry, who?
Pascal Charbonneau.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, who, you know, he basically said, you know, like in a lot of cases, you know, he was introduced, you know, as a grandmaster, you know, right. And if nothing else, it, you know, helped for networking, you know, which it, you know, actually has for me when I was in corporate America. You know, I remember a job interview I had for my last corporate America job, actually, at Rapid 7. You know, it was a little bit bittersweet for me. You know, I was like preparing all night, learning about data security. You know, for this final interview that I had, and, you know, my soon-to-be director, you know, literally all he asked me about was chess, you know, and he saw I'm a national master, it's on my resume, you know, he said, oh my God, you must be so smart, blah, 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 you know, and that was it, you know, he didn't ask me a single question about data security, which was good, but at the same time, I was like, wow, I barely slept, because I was, like, trying to learn data security all night, you know, for no reason. So yeah, I thought that was, you know, fairly fascinating. You know, the last major, you know, topic I wanted to cover, I know you, you know, recently wrote a book, on the French exchange variation, which, you know, recently, you know, come out. You know, honestly, I was curious, you know, a lot of chess teachers, you know, relatively early on tell students not to play the French exchange, you know, variation, as it is known to be, you know, somewhat drawish, you know, compared to, you know, the Tirache classical, you know, other variation. So, what made you write this book?
Well, first of all, that's just not true that it's drawish, right?
Fair enough. I mean, maybe it's a misnomer, but, you know, just, you know.
It had a reputation of that because of a couple of games that were played, but, a lot of people don't know that that was actually the main line of the French in the 19th century. And I don't think that people played for a draw. People like Paul Morphy and Adolf Anderson and Chigorin played the exchange French actually with white, believe it or not. And I don't think people like that played for draws. I don't think 19th century players played for draws. It was the main line. And, you know, you get an open position and sometimes you get an isolated pawn. Like you can take and then you play either c4 immediately or c4, like in a couple of moves, and white gets an isolated queen pawn. That's not a drawish position. That you get an isolated queen pawn to try to attack. So to answer your question, though, what made me write the book? Actually, it's funny that the one of the grandmasters you mentioned is a friend of yours, Robert Hungaski, indirectly was was the inspiration of this book because he was talking to Hannon Russell, who is the publisher, my publisher. And he told him, you know, why doesn't Alex write this book about the exchange French? I saw him play these games. And I don't know what games he saw and I don't know why he even noticed because I'd never played against him with white. So I don't know what he wouldn't have been preparing against me because I'd never played against him with white. I only played with black. But he must have noticed some game somewhere, and you know, Hannon told me, you know, why don't you write these? You seem to play it really well, and it's true. I mean, I have played it since 1992. There was a Kasparov game I started playing. He was world champion. Obviously, world champion picks up the system. People start following, right? So he played it a couple of times. A lot of people started playing it. It was very popular in the early 90s, and it kind of faded away a little bit. But I was playing it for a long time. I won some nice games with it. I beat Gulko with it. And, you know, it was not a draw. It was not at all a drawish system. There's sometimes you have to be careful to fall into a drawish line here and there. But there are many ways to get out of, you know, possible.
Yeah, I mean, you raised an interesting point there. And, you know, by the way, look, I've been mainly playing the French Terrasse for many years. And, I'm in a game that's equalized against that, of course. You know, and the classical is, very sharp. By the way, one thing, you probably don't know, actually, is Henry Russell, of course, is also on our podcast. And Grandmaster Yudasin and I are actually in the beginning of stages of writing a book that will most likely be released by him, actually. So I learned with Yudasin for, you know, several years. And we're actually working on a book about, second tier openings and how to play against them.
Really?
Okay. Actually. So hopefully that'll be out in the next couple of years. You know, right now we're somewhat in the beginning stages.
I've worked with Hannon for a while. There's actually another project which I can't quite discuss yet, but I'm working with him as well. That I'm working on. But a lot of stuff I've done has been with this I've done a lot of work with Carsten Mueller on the end games, on revising the Dvoretsky endgame manual. That was a big project that I worked on as well. It takes more time than sometimes writing a book of your own.
Well, it's just great to see that, you obviously have a full-time, day job, but you have a lot of time for chess, both writing and playing. Look, Patrick Wolf was on our podcast a couple of weeks ago, for instance, mm-hmm. Pascal. Actually we'll be on in a couple of weeks. Look, these guys are great people. But they're not playing so much. You know, they're more doing their day job. So it's great to see that you're doing both.
Yeah.
So
I mean different people.
Alex, I just wanted to, really thank you for, taking some time, talking about really a variety of subjects, from winning the Denker, in Florida, to some general topics. Improvement tips, the importance of, endgame study, working with your son, to become a master, getting into, a little bit of the applications of chess and finance, some of the misnomers of the French exchange, and of course, talking about your latest book, about the French exchange variation. Is there anything else you'd like to add while you're on the podcast?
No, I mean, it's a pleasure to be on. I always like to hear about things going on in the chess community. And, I'll just say that even though I've moved geographically to Tennessee, it's probably not going to affect the number of tournaments I play in because I'm, my son Mitch, he goes to Lehigh University. So I'm going to be, and also work-wise, I'm probably going to have to be spending about a week, a month or something like that in the New York area anyway. So I don't think that I'll still be playing a lot of tournaments in the East Coast.
Well, that's great to hear. And I'm sure, Mitch playing a lot of tournaments is kind of keeping you motivated to, continue as well. So, Alex, last question I always like to ask if you'd like to, provide if anyone has, any questions, maybe about the book or, any, potential future partnerships and whatnot. Is there a way people could reach you?
Yeah, I mean, my email is public. It's afish@panix.com. It's on my website. If you go gmalexfishbein.com, I don't do a very good job of maintaining that website, but you can find my email easily. So yeah, anybody can send me an email.
Okay, wonderful. And of course, if any of our listeners did not catch that, would like to reach out to Alex, you can certainly reach out to us as well. And we'd love to get you in touch. And Alex, thank you so much for your time today. And we look forward to seeing your progress in the next book.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care.
I'll talk to you soon.